Before we get into today's episode, we want to tell you about another show from the team behind The Final Hours, Hidden History with Dr. Harini Bhatt.
Every Monday, Dr. Bhatt goes where history gets uncomfortable. Vanished civilizations, doomsday prophecies, paranormal phenomena, and events that science still can't fully explain.
She'll give you historical context, break down the science, and even interrogate the supernatural, and ask, what if it happened today?
Hidden History drops every Monday. Follow now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen so you never miss a mystery.
This is Crime House.
It's April 16th, 2005, in a small historic Pennsylvania river town called Lewisburg. You're looking at a one-story brick building decorated with green and brown striped awnings. A sign out front reads, Street of Shops, an indoor antique mall with 375 vendors. Inside, the halls resemble old town streets lined with quaint storefront facades. There's an antique bank teller window, park benches, and vintage streetlights. It's the last place anyone laid eyes on Ray Frank Grecar.
The building backs up to a thin wooded area lining the Susquehanna River. Across the street is a gravel parking lot. One of the cars parked there is a 2004 red Mini Cooper with a white top. The doors are locked and the keys are nowhere to be found. But there's a cell phone and a water bottle inside. The car smells faintly like smoke and there's a little bit of cigarette ash on the passenger seat floor mat. This is the last place Ray parked his car before he vanished that day, in this quiet, ordinary little spot. But Ray Grecar was not the type to just walk away from his life. He was responsible, professional, and about to retire. And with no note, no signs of a struggle, and no body, his case becomes even more of a mystery. Every year, over 500,000 people go missing, and that's just in the United States alone. Most of those stories barely get a headline. Some don't even get a flyer or a tip line. And when cases do get media attention, we usually only get the broad strokes.
But for those of us who have lived these true crime cases, we know the devil's in the details. This is The Final Hours, a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios. I'm Sarah Turney.
And I'm Courtney Nicole. Every Monday, Sarah and I will be looking at the final hours of someone's disappearance, the small, seemingly mundane moments to see if there was anything hiding in plain sight.
Looking back at those last conversations, connections, and choices is critical, and it could be the key to unlocking it all. Each episode, I'll offer insight on what those close to the victim might have been going through. And Courtney will use her expertise to give more context into the crime scene, the red flags, and the investigation itself. And we want to thank you for being a part of the Crime House community. Please rate, review, and follow the show. And for ad-free access to every episode, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts.
This time, we're discussing the disappearance of 59-year-old Ray Frank Grecar. On a sunny day in April 2005, Ray played hooky from work. That morning, he took a scenic drive east, parked his car at an antiques mall he frequented, and was never seen again. But his computer was, and it might hold the key to solving his disappearance. Ray Grecar's case must have felt tragically familiar to his family. His older brother Roy disappeared almost a decade before he did, in a strangely similar way. But the difference is that Roy's body was found, and his case was closed. Decades after Ray's disappearance, we're still left wondering what happened to him and if he might still be alive today. But before we discuss Ray's fate and the heartbreaking circumstances surrounding his family, let's talk about his life.
It's 2005. 59-year-old Ray Frank Grecar is the district attorney of Centre County, Pennsylvania. People know him as this hardworking, meticulous guy who's kind of aloof. Born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, Ray went to college downstate at the University of Dayton, where he majored in political science. When Ray was a junior, he offered a freshman named Barbara Gray a ride home. And the rest was history. The two became inseparable. At the time, Ray was looking into getting his master's degree in Russian history. He only became interested in the law after working an internship at a prosecutor's office. That's where Ray realized his dream was to become a career prosecutor. In 1968, when Barbara graduated with her degree in chemistry, the couple moved back north to Cleveland. Ray attended law school at Case Western Reserve University, and Barbara worked at a research lab. They tied the knot in 1969. Ray and Barbara wanted a family, so they were heartbroken to learn that they couldn't have children biologically. But in 1978, they adopted a little girl named Laura, and Ray devoted himself to being a father. In 1979, Barbara joined the faculty at Penn State. Because of that, the family of three moved from Ohio to the town of State College, Pennsylvania. For the first year, Ray stayed home to raise Laura. That meant waffles most mornings, outings to the park together, and flying kites in a cornfield near their house.
Then came 1980. That year, an assistant district attorney position opened up under Center County DA David E. Grine. It was the perfect job for Ray, so he could not turn it down. And when Grine's successor chose not to run again in 1985, it was Ray who was elected as the Center County District Attorney. And that's how things were until 1991. But that year, Ray and Barbara got divorced, but they remained on friendly terms and stayed in touch to co-parent Laura.
Things got worse for Ray before they got better, though, because in 1996, the Greekars had their first big family tragedy. That January, Ray's older brother, 53-year-old Roy Greekar, retired from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. He lived with his wife and three grade school sons in Westchester, Ohio. 5 months later, at 5:30 p.m. on May 8, 1996, Roy told his wife he was going to the gas station to buy mulch. Then he'd pick up their 9-year-old son from his friend's house. He left home in his Toyota Camry, but never made it to either location.
2 days later, Roy's car was found at a park in Dayton, which was close to a bridge over the Great Miami River. 8 days after that, on May 18th, Roy's body was pulled out of the water. His death was ruled as a suicide by drowning. Roy was being medicated for depression, but Ray never believed that he would die by suicide. He didn't think that his brother would leave his three sons, Tony, Chris, and Andrew, without a father. So every time Ray went to visit his family back in Ohio, he would check with the police to see if there were any new leads in Roy's case. Man, I feel like it has to be really, really tough when you have authorities coming to you and saying that you have a loved one, you know, who ended their own life, when at the end of the day, you just don't believe that they would do that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. It's so hard, especially when there's no note and you're kind of just left wondering and analyzing and going over all the clues and evidence for yourself. It just has to be torture.
Yeah, I feel like you always think that you know your family best, but sometimes there are simply just no signs until it happens. And it's just really, really unfortunate.
Yeah. I do think that this is a good time to share the hotline, though, right? That you can call or text 988. Web chat is also available at 988lifeline.org if you need help.
I was just going to say, on the flip side of that, I feel like it also might be hard for like investigators too, when they're kind of doing everything by the book and trying to stick to like the facts of the case, which in some cases do point to suicide. But at the end of the day, the family doesn't think that or want to think their loved one would die by suicide. It's kind of just tough for every single party involved. I can't even imagine.
Yeah, I mean, especially something like that involving water and a vehicle. I mean, it feels like it could go either way. Over the years, Ray stayed close with his nephews, Tony, Chris, and Andrew. He cared a lot about his family. So it must have been hard when 20-year-old Laura moved from Pennsylvania to Mammoth Lakes, California in the fall of 97. But at least he still got to see her about 4 times a year. Things got scary, though, in 2001 when Laura had a near-fatal snowboarding accident. Ray dropped everything to go out west and take care of her. For a month, he rented a condo and changed the dressings on her back. But 2001 had ups as well as downs. That's when 55-year-old Ray started dating 38-year-old Patty Fornicola. She was a clerk at the district attorney's office, and they'd both gone through divorces, so they had a bit in common. On their first date, Ray and Patty drove 4 hours to Cleveland, where he showed her the house he grew up in. Over time, things got more serious, and he eventually moved into her childhood home, which she now owned in Bellefonte, Pennsylvania, about 23 minutes away from State College. The change in scenery seemed to do him good. Ray had always had a dry sense of humor, but he was becoming more outgoing and playful as he neared his 60s. Every Friday night, he and Patty went to the Gamble Mill Inn. They played Trivial Pursuit while Ray enjoyed a Grey Goose martini. And their relationship was still going strong by 2005.
At this point, Ray's been a prosecutor for 30 years and a district attorney for 19. He decides not to seek re-election for a 6th term. He's going to retire in December at the age of 60. and he plans to really enjoy his life. Ray and Patty often talk about what they'll do after his retirement. Ray enjoys traveling, antiquing, and outdoor activities. He only has 7 months to go, and he's really looking forward to it. They plan to take long road trips and visit Lara, where she now lives, in Washington State. Ray's also planning a trip to visit family in Ohio soon. He'll see Roy's sons while he's there. But as the calendar turns to spring in 2005, Ray is still working hard, and he seems more fatigued than usual. He takes naps after work and sometimes even during lunch. Patty encourages him to see a doctor in case something is going on physically or even mentally, but Lara thinks Ray seems fine. They speak on the phone about 3 times a week, including on Thursday, April 14th. Lara calls him just to tell him she loves him, and of course, he says, "I love you too."
The next morning, Friday, April 15th, 2005, 59-year-old Ray sits up in bed. Patty brings him a glass of orange juice, and he tells her he's taking the day off work. This isn't unusual for Ray. Every once in a while, he likes to play hooky and just go for a drive. Patty kisses him and leaves for the Center County Courthouse, since she still works in the DA's office there. After she leaves, Ray throws on jeans, white sneakers, and a blue fleece jacket. Then he hops into the car. The weather's in the 60s and sunny as he heads east. Around 11:30 a.m., Ray calls Patty to let her know that he's driving on State Route 192. If he has any plans or a final destination, he doesn't mention it. They speak briefly about the stuff that needs to be done at home, and he says he won't be back in time to feed and walk the dog, Honey. Before he hangs up, he tells Patty, "I love you." And she says, "I love you back."
I feel like Ray and Patty's relationship is just so cute. Like, I love, you know, them introducing each other to their childhood homes, and now they're living in hers. And I think when Ray starts, like, experiencing more fatigue as, you know, the days go on, I think it's really sweet of Patty to, like, be worried about him and want him to get checked out. But in my personal opinion, I feel like, you know, he's getting older and he has a really highly demanding job. In my personal opinion, I don't feel like it's odd or, like, bizarre for him to be feeling tired.
Yeah, no, I feel exactly the same way. Like, one, their first date is so cute. To go to the childhood home is just adorable, right? But yeah, I totally agree with you. This fatigue could be from anything. It could be a stressful week, a stressful day. It could be just getting older. It's really hard to say.
Exactly. I mean, I'm 27 and I feel like I get tired most days, so I can relate to him. I don't think it's anything out of the ordinary.
Exactly. I could have a day where I just need to lay down in the middle of the day. I think it happens to all of us.
I also feel like a person's, like, rituals can really help investigators get more insight into a case. And in this case, it's tough because I feel like most of the time it can help an investigation. But in Ray's case, like, he's kind of just doing what he already does, like, a lot, like what he typically does, which is playing hooky and, you know, going for a little drive or, you know, going antiquing. Like, it's something that he is known to do. So I feel like in this specific case, his routine and ritual doesn't really help investigators.
I mean, this is a tough case overall, but I totally agree. And, you know, he's nearing retirement. He's playing hooky. It's not unusual, but, you know, could it be purposeful? I don't know.
Yeah, I also feel like, you know, somebody's ritual, it could just be a really good indicator whether something seems off or not. Depending on, like, the circumstance, it could help somebody walk away.
Yeah, no, I agree. It could go either way. And I think that's what makes this case so hard in particular. We know taking a random day off is on brand for Ray, but Patty imagines he'll be home by the time she returns from work at 5 p.m. So when he doesn't come back, Patty gets concerned. To take her mind off of it, she heads to the YMCA to work out. When she gets back, Ray still isn't there. She tries his cell over and over, but keeps getting his voicemail. She leaves him several messages.
Finally, around 11:30 p.m., Patty calls the Bellefonte police and reports Ray missing. He's still gone with the car, and oddly enough, something else is missing that he never takes with him. Ray's county laptop.
It's Saturday, April 16th, one day since Patty last saw Ray. That's when she starts calling his family members to let them know he's missing. Meanwhile, the state police are searching central Pennsylvania for any sign of his car. They also issue a bulletin to 6 neighboring states. At first, they think he might have taken an impromptu detour 4 hours west of his home in Bellefonte to watch the Cleveland Indians play. He's gone to baseball games on a whim before without telling anyone. So they ask the Ohio authorities to look around for Ray. But that evening, Pennsylvania police found Ray's red and white Mini Cooper.
It's in Lewisburg, 55 miles east from Bellefonte, in a parking lot across from an antiques market that he's been known to visit, called the Street of Shops. The market is in front of a shallow wooded area on the edge of the Susquehanna River. Nearby, there's an abandoned, rusted railroad bridge and a newer traffic bridge used by cars to drive across the river.
The location of the car is eerily reminiscent of the scene with Ray's brother Roy. Roy's car was also parked along a river just a couple blocks away from a traffic bridge. But in this case, Ray's car doors are locked and the keys are gone. A water bottle and Ray's cell phone are still inside, but the cell phone's turned off, which is unusual. Ray always keeps it on when he's on the road, and he always makes sure to call or email the office when he's running late or taking the day off. Chances are, if he got out of the car willingly, he would have taken it. So this is worrisome.
There's something else weird inside the car. The air smells faintly of cigarettes, and there's a little bit of ash on the passenger seat floor mat, another piece of evidence that shocks the people who know Ray. He really does not like cigarettes. He would never want someone to be smoking in his Mini Cooper. So the car opens up a lot of questions, but now that the police have found it, they can start collecting witness statements. And at least three people who work in or near the antique mall saw someone who looked like Ray that weekend.
A woman named Jennifer Snyder, who works a block away from the mall at the Packwood House Museum, saw Ray on Friday around noon. She looked out the window and noticed Ray standing near his parked Mini Cooper. She noticed it because the distinct British car was featured in the Italian Job remake.
Down the street, a man named Brad Alvey, the owner of a new restaurant being built at Street of Shops, was working long hours to oversee the project. He saw Ray, but says he's not sure if it was Friday or Saturday. According to Brad, Ray seemed to be having a nice time just moseying along.
Then there was a witness named Craig Bennett, the owner of the Street of Shops complex. Around noon on Saturday, a day after Patty last saw Ray, Craig stopped by the antique mall to check out the last phase of the new restaurant construction. Craig tells police he noticed a man who fit Ray's description standing about 8 to 10 feet from where they were building. He wasn't shopping or browsing. He just stood there for 5 to 10 solid minutes, like he was waiting for someone. According to Craig, he looked anxious and tense. The mall owner didn't see Ray leave, if his demeanor had changed, what time it was, or if he was with someone.
Other witnesses report seeing Ray with an attractive Caucasian woman in her 30s or 40s. She was tall, about 5'9", with dark chin-length hair. They aren't sure if Ray was shopping with her or if they just happened to cross paths several times and exchanged niceties.
I feel like witness statements can be so tough, but if these people had seen Ray here before, I feel like that could change things.
Yeah, I was just going to say, especially in this location where he has been known to frequent like many times, I'm sure that's just like another level of like frustrating because I feel like it's been well established that he was there. And without much to go on, you have these witness statements, which is on one hand great, but if we can't narrow down the day, I feel like that's a big time frame that is just crucial.
Oh yeah, that makes a huge difference, right? I wish that witness testimony was more reliable. These witness statements just notoriously can be hard to decipher.
I definitely feel for Patty and the rest of the family.
Well, yeah, I'm sure they're trying to narrow down exactly what date it could be too.
I think one thing that I always circle back to when it comes to this case is the cigarette ash on his floor mat. He normally would like never allow that to happen. That's, I feel like, a really, really big clue to me that something is not right.
I think that it definitely indicates that something is out of the ordinary here, whether somebody else was driving his car, somebody was in the passenger seat who wasn't supposed to be there.
I think it really does narrow down that somebody really was inside of his car.
Okay, maybe I'm just nitpicking too much, but like, was the window down? Is there any world in which somebody could be walking by and they just like, you know, ash their cigarette in his window for fun or to be a jerk?
Yeah, I guess that could happen. I guess because I personally would never do that. So like, I can't imagine somebody else doing that.
Yeah, I mean, I guess to play devil's advocate though, right? If the car smells like cigarettes, I think it's fair to say that they were probably in there. I guess I just think of like every possibility, and I have to imagine that the police know that answer. But I also can't get over the cell phone being turned off and left in the car.
Yeah, that's really weird, turned off too. I just feel like Ray, I mean, obviously I didn't know him personally, but just based off of like his family's description of him, I just don't think that he would have done that. Like, I don't think he would leave his family high and dry like that and just like go no contact.
Well, if you remember, Ray's daughter Laura is currently living in Washington State, but she drops everything when her dad disappears. She and her fiancé are closing on a house near Seattle, but she leaves him to deal with the move. She's also in school at the moment, but drops her classes for the term to help with the investigation. Laura arrives in Pennsylvania on Saturday, April 17th, 2 days after her dad left home. Her mom Barbara and her cousins Tony and Chris meet her at the airport. Ray's family and friends set up a headquarters at Patty's.
With no evidence of foul play, the missing persons case remains in the jurisdiction of the Bellefonte Police Department because that's where Ray lives. But they call in help from the State College Police and the Pennsylvania State Police. They get divers to search in the river, helicopters to search along the banks, and dogs to track Ray's scent. Within days, the FBI also helps analyze Ray's bank and phone records. Nobody has used his credit cards or assessed his account since the Friday he went missing, and the call to Patty at 11:30 a.m. on Friday was, in fact, the last one he'd made from his cell phone. The data from his call logs also confirm what Ray told Patty. He was driving on State Route 192 at the time. There is one device the FBI can't search, though, and that's Ray's work laptop. Why? Because it's missing. Which is alarming because it contains sensitive information, and he doesn't usually take it with him when he travels. The laptop isn't at home, where it should be, or in his car. Investigators do look through Ray's office and home desktop computers. They scour his files, calendar, and search history. And they find that he hasn't sent emails from any of his accounts. They also check his medical records and find nothing out of the ordinary.
Three general theories are floating around the media at this point. That Ray was murdered because of his involvement with a case, that Ray died by suicide, or that Ray either ran off to start a new life willingly, or as a part of a witness protection program. There's no evidence that any threats were made against Ray, though. As for the police, they don't have a theory yet, but they don't suspect the district attorney's disappearance is related to any of his cases, past or present. Ray's disappearance really hits his coworkers on Monday, April 18th, 2005, because he has a courthouse hearing for a drug case scheduled at 9:30 a.m. If he was just gone for the weekend, he would have made sure to be back in time for this.
But he does not show up, and that same day, on Monday, April 18th, two witnesses report a possible sighting of Ray near Wilkes Bar, about 65 miles east of the street of shops where Ray's car was found, and 120 miles from where he lives in Bellefonte. Police never give the exact location of the sighting, but the witness is a bartender. The man he thinks was Ray talked to him about baseball and being from Cleveland while drinking a Heineken and watching the Indians game on TV. This sounds like Ray, but there's no indication of where he went from there, if that was him.
That week, Laura and her mom Barbara drive to stores all over Lewisburg to show people photos of Ray. They bump into police officers doing the same thing, but even after hitting every business in town, they still have no new information.
On Wednesday, May 4th, 2005, the state crime lab says they have some results. They'd collected and run the water bottle in Ray's car for DNA analysis, and they confirm that he was the one who drank from it.
There's another sighting later that month. A man and his daughter had seen Ray's picture on a Fox News show, and on May 27th, 2005, they think they spot him. The man they identify as Ray is at a restaurant in Southfield, Michigan, a suburb of Detroit, with a woman who looks to be in her 70s. But the sighting can't be confirmed.
I think it's really hard in situations like this when you have a loved one go missing. And whether like your family is really, really close or not, I feel like when something this devastating happens, a lot of the times I see it really kind of like bring everyone together.
I mean, this family is obviously amazing for them to really drop everything and his daughter to drop classes, to let her fiance move alone, which I'm sure he completely understood. But you don't always see it, but I do love to see it.
I also feel like with this family's backstory and like the history of losing Roy, I feel like they don't want this to be another situation just like that. So I feel like they're all kind of banding together immediately to help find Ray. I feel like police really kind of go by the book, which is obviously a good thing. You know, there are different avenues that a family can go down that could potentially help, you know, the case.
Yeah, no, definitely. I think that there's a way that families can think outside of the box a little bit more than police, right? Police do this all day, every day, but families know their loved one better than anybody. So I feel like even though, you know, in Ray's position, he's probably getting a ton of police resources, it doesn't hurt to have his family out there either, right? Like the family running into the police handing out flyers, I don't see anything wrong with that. It doesn't seem like they're impeding in any way, especially when it comes to looking for a missing person. It feels like you really want to get the most media you can and get the word out there everywhere you can, which seems to be what both sides are doing, law enforcement and this family. Let's jump to Saturday, July 30th, 2005, 3.5 months since Ray went missing. That day, two fishermen are out on the Susquehanna River in Lewisburg. The water is relatively clear and shallow right now, about 4.5 to 5 feet deep. The fishermen notice something under the State Route 45 bridge, the one a couple of blocks away from the street of shops. They throw their net in the water and scoop out a laptop. It has an inventory tag on it from the Center County Commissioner's office, so they call the state police.
As soon as they retrieve the laptop, a forensic computer specialist starts their analysis, but they don't get far because the hard drive has gone missing. There's no way to get information off of it.
Ray mostly uses this laptop to research and prepare for cases. But in DA cases, he reviews findings that police officers forward to him, which means it's unlikely his computer would host the only copy of any sensitive information. So why steal his hard drive? The police also don't believe Ray had a lot of personal information stored on the hard drive of his work laptop since he had a computer at home. Either way, it seems like someone intentionally threw the laptop into the river. The question is, was it Ray or someone else?
Dive teams searched the water back in April when Ray's car was found, but they didn't find the laptop then. So the other question is, was it thrown in when Ray disappeared or by someone else after? Unfortunately, there's no way to get fingerprints off the computer or to tell how long it's been in the water.
If you ask some of Ray's friends and family, they say it points to homicide. Tony isn't sure his uncle is tech-savvy enough to remove a hard drive on his own. And his DA buddy Ted McKnight thinks he could, but wouldn't.
It's worth noting that this is a pop-out hard drive. So Ray or anyone else definitely could have removed it pretty easily, or it could have fallen out of the computer. But police aren't going to get many answers until they can find the hard drive itself. So dive teams from the Sunbury Fire Department searched the river again on Saturday, July 30th and Sunday, July 31st. But they don't find anything worth noting.
I feel like we have another clue here that just leads to more questions than answers.
I don't know. I feel like in any other case, if it didn't involve a body of water, I feel like a piece of evidence being found later, it could lead to something being suspicious. But if it involves water, especially in like a river like this, you just don't know like what's going to happen if someone or something goes in the water. It's just hard to tell if it was placed when Ray disappeared or sometime after, if it's through like a fast moving body of water.
Yeah, I mean, we know that the laptop didn't like blow into the river, right? I think that that possibility is extremely unlikely. I won't say it's completely not possible because we've seen stranger things, right? But I mean, it feels like it was placed there intentionally. And especially we're looking at this time frame, right? This was over 20 years ago. I think that the general opinion is if you throw something into the water, especially something electronic, it's no longer going to work. But that being said, maybe somebody at the DA's office who knows more about the details of these investigations and the techniques that they can use to recover electronics, maybe they would know that it is recoverable if it is, you know? Like, I feel like they would know more than the average person about throwing an electronic into a body of water.
A lot of that information that could have been on this hard drive can be easily replicated anywhere else, like within his employment. I don't know. I feel like I'm kind of split down the middle. All I'll say that I know, the laptop was placed in the water intentionally. I feel like that's kind of the way I'm leaning.
Yeah, that seems very likely to me, I'll say, right? And yeah, I just have to think about like what they're looking for on that laptop. We know that these court documents and even, you know, pieces of evidence are replicated, right? So this doesn't contain, you know, the smoking gun for a case that a criminal might want because that's going to exist somewhere else, right? But what if they were trying to access his email account to send an email to somebody or even letterhead?
Yeah, I feel like it's really tough for me when you have somebody in like Ray's position. I feel like I try not to speculate on if that could potentially be connected or not. But like, I feel like it's really hard not to when you have somebody in this type of career and then they suddenly like go missing when they show no other signs that they would just like run away.
I mean, it could be somebody trying to access something, right? Because I think anybody who sees a DA's computer is going to think, oh, that's valuable, right? There's got to be something on there. But what if something happened that was unexpected? They realized that Ray was, you know, a part of the prosecutor's office and then panicked and tried to get rid of the laptop.
About 2.5 months after Ray's computer is found, in mid-October 2005, a woman and her son are skipping rocks along the Susquehanna riverbank. Something catches their eye about 15 feet from the water's edge. A hard drive that had been pressed into the mud where the water receded, about 100 yards upstream from where Ray's laptop was found. They turn it over to the state police. It's the same model as Ray's computer, which means they might finally get some answers. It's mid-October 2005, 6 months since 59-year-old Ray Grecar disappeared. State police finally have the hard drive from the missing district attorney's laptop. The problem is, the hard drive's in terrible shape, so they ship it to an FBI facility hoping they can recover some information. The Bellefonte police think this could be the key to where Ray went. If Ray walked away from his life, the hard drive might show travel plans or secret financial records. If he died by suicide, he might have kept a journal. Or if he was the victim of foul play, the computer could hold information about who was targeting him. But whatever is on the hard drive, the FBI can't read it, and the investigation is stalled for almost 3 years.
Ray's friends are frustrated. On Tuesday, June 3rd, 2008, a close buddy of Ray's, Montour County DA Bob Buhner, writes a letter to the two DAs in charge of Ray's case, Center County DA Michael Madera and Uni County DA Pete Johnson. The letter asked them to follow a few leads identified by him and another colleague, former Clinton County DA Ted McKnight. Bob and Ted want the police to search hotels in the area for female customers. If Ray was still in Lewisburg on April 16th, the day after he was last seen at home, he would have slept somewhere. And people saw him talking to the tall Caucasian woman with dark, chin-length hair at the street of shops. Bob and Ted also want Ray's hard drive analyzed by a company out of Minnesota called Kroll On Track. In 2003, when the space shuttle Columbia re-entered the Earth's atmosphere, the entire vessel disintegrated. Kroll was able to recover data off of hardware that was pulled from the debris. Basically, they're the best in the industry. Only Bob and Ted don't hear back from the DAs about their suggestions. So, a month later, on Tuesday, July 1st, 2008, they hold a press conference at Soldiers Park, near where Ray's car was found. They publicly call out the two DAs on the case, along with the state attorney general. They criticize how the investigation has been handled and share their leads.
Bob and Ted make some pretty good points. They don't believe Ray could have committed suicide without his body being found. They think the river is too shallow. They're positive Ray loves his daughter too much and is too excited about retirement to disappear without a word. Ray is unmarried and without financial obligation, so there isn't much in his personal life for him to run from. They also point out their own experiences with death threats. Bob's sheriff has a list of 10 names to start with if Bob ever disappears. He believes almost every DA receives death threats, that it's an occupational hazard. At least the press conference is a success. Center County DA Michael Madera and the Bellefonte police say they're working on getting the hard drive to Kroll, but they don't know how soon it will be analyzed. Over the next few months, the DA and the police follow through. On Tuesday, September 30th, 2008, Michael receives a full report from Kroll On Track. In addition to water corrosion and crash damage, previous attempts to retrieve data have done some of their own damage. Kroll can't tell if the hard drive was wiped, but no data can be recovered.
At this point, people start to share stories. Turns out, in the 16 months before Ray disappeared, he asked some friends and colleagues about software that could erase a hard drive. There was even a box for that type of software seen at his house at some point after January 2004. It didn't seem strange at the time. He expressed an interest in cleaning up his county laptop before he retired. He didn't want to return it to the DA's office with his personal information still on it.
Well, on Tuesday, April 14th, 2009, one day before the fourth anniversary of Ray's disappearance, the Bellefonte police release new information. When they examined Ray's home computer back in 2005, they found that he'd searched the internet for how to wreck a hard drive, how to fry a hard drive, and water damage to a notebook computer. He'd also been researching software to erase a hard drive. Some people think the idea that he wiped his own hard drive weakens the foul play theory because that means he had something to hide. But Bob Buhner believes the opposite. He thinks the fact that Ray wanted to wipe information means he had something worth keeping out of a criminal's hands. And if Ray still had the information in his head after it was erased, it would give someone a motive to kill him, to keep him silent.
In June 2011, 34-year-old Laura files a petition with Centre County President Judge David E. Grine for a declaration of her father's death. David is the former DA who Ray started with as assistant DA. Under Pennsylvania law, a missing person can be presumed dead after 7 years. But Ray's family is ready for closure after six. At 2 p.m. on July 25th, Laura, Patty, and a detective from the Bellefonte Police testify. Laura phones in remotely from where she lives, outside of Seattle. She and Patty believe without a doubt that Ray is dead. They don't think he would have entered a witness protection program or walked away from his life. Ray was getting ready for retirement and looking forward to spending more time with his girlfriend and his daughter. Laura was engaged, and Ray knew her fiancé well. Soon, he would have gotten to walk his daughter down the aisle. As for the detective, he testifies that a 6-year investigation has failed to locate the former district attorney. He also doesn't think Ray was involved with anything that would make him a candidate for witness protection. His accounts still haven't been accessed since he disappeared.
I personally don't think I will ever judge a family at any point for wanting to petition for a death certificate. I mean, I feel like they know their loved one really well, and if they feel like the time is right, then I would trust them. I feel like I have no judgment just because I simply have never had to go through something like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a deeply personal choice that every family has to make. And there's a variety of reasons why they could do it, right? One is just for legal matters, things with benefits and, you know, Ray's estate, they could have done it for that. It could also, in some cases, I don't think here necessarily, but some families do it to enact a civil suit, usually a wrongful death suit. So, I mean, there are so many reasons why a family would have someone declared dead. And I will say that it doesn't always impact the investigation. Sometimes it's purely just for legal reasons.
Yeah, I can also see that it could be like maybe a sense of, I don't want to say closure, because obviously there are so many like unanswered questions, but it could just be like a peace of mind thing, like one less thing that they're going to have to do later.
Yeah, I definitely know some families who've done it just for a sense of closure.
Yeah, I don't know if I've ever come across a case where someone's like reappeared after they're legally declared dead. I know I've covered a few cases where people do reappear like several years later, but not after being legally declared dead. And in this case, I just feel like it's been so long since he hasn't been seen in so long. And on top of that, none of his accounts have been accessed. So I feel like at this point, you know, I tend to agree with his family.
Like I said, it's such a deeply personal choice, and it's never easy, even if you are doing it for technical reasons, to have to go through that and testify, in a court of law about how you think your dad is likely dead is not something that people are doing for fun, right? They have a good reason behind it. So I 100% support them.
Especially like you mentioned earlier, when in Ray's case, he probably had so many different resources investigating this case. And if none of them can provide any sort of answer, I can see them wanting to do this, you know, sooner rather than later.
The petition is granted. On July 25th, 2011, Ray Grecar is legally declared dead. It seems clear he's not coming back, and Laura needs to start dealing with his affairs and settling his estate. But if Ray is out there somewhere, his family and Patty want more than anything for him to return home. Even if he walked out, they would welcome him back with open arms. We don't know for sure what happened to Ray, but we do know this. 59-year-old District Attorney Ray Frank Grecar sat up in his bed on Friday, April 15th, 2005. His girlfriend Patty, whose house he shared, brought him a glass of orange juice. He told her he was taking the day off work, which he enjoyed doing once in a while so he could decompress and go for a drive. He was less than a year from retirement, so maybe he had a bit of senioritis. Patty kissed him and left for the DA's office where she also worked. Ray got up, threw on his jeans, pulled on white sneakers and a blue fleece-type jacket. He got into his red and white Mini Cooper and hit the road. It was the perfect spring day for a drive, sunny and in the 60s. Around 11:30 a.m., Ray called Patty. He let her know he was driving on State Route 192 and wouldn't be home in time to feed and walk their dog, Honey. Before hanging up the phone, Ray and Patty finished the call the way any of us hope to end the last conversation with a loved one. He told her the most important thing, "I love you," and she said, "I love you back." Ray kept driving east through rolling hillsides, farm fields, and the Bald Eagle State Forest. And then he arrived at a cute, old-timey antiques market he liked to shop at, Street of Shops, the last place he was ever seen.
Ray Frank Grecar will be about 80 years old as of this recording.
He is a 6-foot-tall Caucasian male with a lean build, graying brown hair, and green eyes. If you have any information about Ray Grecar, you can contact the Pennsylvania State Police at 1-800-4PA-TIPS or submit a tip online at p3tips.com.
Thank you for listening to The Final Hours. If you have any other details about Ray Grecar's case, please share it with us on social media. We want to hear from you. Your thoughts, condolences, and feedback are what make this community so special.
At Crime House, we value your support. Share your thoughts on social media and remember to rate, review, and follow The Final Hours to help others discover the show.
And to enhance your listening experience, subscribe to Crime House Plus on Apple Podcasts. You'll get every episode of The Final Hours ad-free, along with early access and exciting bonus content.
The Final Hours is hosted by Sarah Turney and me, Courtney Nicole, and is a Crime House original powered by Pave Studios. This episode was brought to life by the Final Hours team: Max Cutler, Ron Shapiro, Alex Benadon, Lori Marinelli, Natalie Pertsovsky, Sarah Camp, Dana Brazil Solovey, Andrew Rosenblum, and Russell Nash. Thank you for listening.